First of all, I want to thank you guys all for coming. My name is Alex Cox, those that don't know me. I'm the president of the Federalist Society, and today's event is co-sponsored with the American Constitution Society. So to start things off, I'm going to introduce Alan Gura and Beth Cochran, the president of the American Constitution Society, is going to introduce Dennis Hennigan. Today's debate is titled The Second Amendment and the States, a debate on the future of gun rights. In 2008, the Supreme Court decided the landmark Second Amendment case, D.C. v. Heller, striking down the District of Columbia's firearms regulation as a violation of the Second Amendment. Following that decision, a number of circuits have upheld state and city firearms regulations on the principle that D.C. v. Heller does not apply to the states. Today's debate will be aimed at discussing whether or not the Second Amendment should be incorporated against the states. Our first speaker today, Alan Gura, was the lead attorney in D.C. v. Heller and argued the case before the Supreme Court. Alan graduated from Georgetown Law School, clerked for U.S. District Judge Terrence Boyle, served as Deputy Attorney General for the state of California, worked in private practice at Sidley Austin in Washington, D.C., and served as counsel to the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Criminal Justice Oversight, all before founding his own firm, Gura & Paseski. Alan is currently lead counsel in the Chicago gun case, McDonald v. NRA, which seeks to incorporate the Second Amendment against the states. His petition for certiorari is currently pending before the Supreme Court.
Thank you. As Alex said, I'm Beth Cochran. I'm the president of ACS here at the law school, and it's my pleasure to introduce Dennis Hennigan. He is the vice president for law and policy at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence and founder of its Legal Action Project. He is the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy. For 20 years, he has been a leading advocate for stronger gun laws, appearing dozens of times on national television and radio shows, including 60 Minutes, The Today Show, Nightline, Larry King Live, and Dateline NBC. He also has written and spoken extensively on liability and constitutional issues relating to gun laws and gun violence, including testifying before several congressional committees. Under his direction, Brady Center lawyers have recovered millions of dollars in damages for gun violence victims, as well as winning precedent-setting decisions on the liability of gun sellers. In 2004, he was named one of the top 10 lawyers of the year by Lawyers Weekly magazine. His work as a public interest lawyer has been profiled in The New Yorker. Hennigan received his BA from Oberlin College in 1973 and his law degree in 1977 from the University of Virginia School of Law. Prior to joining the Brady Center in 1989, he was a partner in the law firm of Foley and Lardner. And now I'll briefly describe how the debate's going to progress here. Alan's going to stand up and give the affirmative argument for 10 minutes, and then Dennis is going to give us the negative argument for 10 minutes. After that, Alan will have an affirmative rebuttal for 5 minutes, and then there's going to be a negative rebuttal for another 5 minutes. Upon that point, there will be an open discussion and Q&A for about 30 minutes. So then we'll have the reception following that, and you can certainly talk to Dennis and Alan with any further points you have. At this point, I'd like to welcome Alan to the podium.
Thanks. Thanks so much for being here. It's always great to see Dennis, a fellow advocate for strong gun laws. I also am an advocate for strong gun laws, except the strong gun law I like is the Second Amendment. In any event, the question now is whether or not the Second Amendment right is going to be incorporated as against the states and local governments. And if everything that we say here tonight leaves you thirsting for more information, you're welcome to visit www.chicagoguncase.com. Chicagoguncase.com is a website that I've set up that tracks McDonald versus City of Chicago, one of the current cases that's before the court, seeking to have the incorporation issue answered. There's a case filings page there where we do put up all the pleadings in our case, not just our material, but also that of the city and the amici on all sides as they come in. And so it's a wonderful resource for people seeking more information. And of course, we still have available dcguncase.com, which did the same thing for the Heller case. There's a case filings page there with a remarkable library that includes all 67 amicus briefs, the parties' briefs, and everything else. So definitely a lot of information out there. I'm fairly confident that the Supreme Court will incorporate the Second Amendment right as against the states. The only question that's up in the air is which path the court will take to do so. As most of you know, since you're in law school, it's not exactly a lay audience. The Bill of Rights originally was conceived as binding only upon the federal government. It was always understood, at least since Barron versus City of Baltimore in the 1830s, that the federal government was bound by the Bill of Rights, but that states and localities were not. After the Civil War, this state of events had to be revisited. It became quite clear that states and local governments were very capable of violating the basic core civil rights of American citizens in ways that were no longer acceptable to society, or at least to that part of society that prevailed in the Civil War. And so the 14th Amendment was designed in part to get rid of Barron versus Baltimore and to make sure, as Section 1 of the 14th Amendment provides, that no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. As that text is plainly written, as it was understood at the time by everybody, those who were in favor of the 14th Amendment and the losers of the war who were against it, there was no debate whatsoever that the Privileges or Immunities Clause was designed to incorporate the entire Bill of Rights, as well as other various sundry traditional rights, civil rights that were inherent in the concept of being a member of a functional society. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court, in the very first case taking upon the 14th Amendment, ruled in the Slaughterhouse Cases, 1873, that the only rights you had under the Privileges or Immunities Clause were those rights that came out of the creation of the federal government itself, which means, to everyone's surprise, that the Civil War was actually fought in order to guarantee everybody the right to a passport, the right to travel upon the waterways of the United States, maybe the right to petition the Congress, not a whole lot else. Clearly, this is wrong, and virtually everybody today, not everybody, some people disagree, but it's general consensus across the political spectrum in American law schools today that Slaughterhouse was wrongly decided and needs to be revisited. However, in the intervening years, although Slaughterhouse remains good law, there is another incorporation doctrine, one which is used much more frequently, and that, of course, is the idea that the Due Process Clause has a substantive element to it, and if liberty has a substantive element, that does encompass at least some of the rights in the Bill of Rights, and so the court has gone about a process of selective incorporation. That is, every once in a while, a case goes to the court, and the court considers whether or not a particular right that's stated in the Bill of Rights does in fact apply to the states of the Due Process Clause. I know some people struggle with the concept of substantive due process. It's certainly not as straightforward and easy conceptually as the Privileges or Immunities Clause. However, that is the operative law today. So the question before us is, number one, can we get rid of Slaughterhouse? Will we incorporate the Second Amendment under the Privileges or Immunities Clause, as some justices might prefer if they have a more originalist, historical rooting to their approach to the law? Or should we simply apply precedent and consider the Second Amendment under due process? I think either way we would win. We don't need to overrule Slaughterhouse, although I am arguing for it, because the traditional incorporation doctrine tells us that we look to several factors, all of which were discussed at length in Heller, and all of which point towards incorporation, just as most of the Bill of Rights is incorporated. Traditionally, the court, in its analysis, looks to three factors to determine whether or not a right is of the kind that's incorporated. First of all, the court looks to see whether or not the right is one that is historically rooted in our legal tradition. Well, here, Heller was very clear, tracing back the right to arms to jolly old England and Blackstone's theory that if one had the right to preserve life, one also has the auxiliary right to the arms with which to do so. We know now that notwithstanding the alternative, some would say fanciful, I would say fanciful history offered by the Stevens dissent, the fact is that the Second Amendment codified a pre-existing traditional right that was well-rooted and fundamental in English law during the colonial period, at least by the colonial period. So we can check off the historical roots, deeply rooted in Anglo-American tradition of that, there's no question. Next, the court usually looks or would look to see whether or not this is a right that's been respected in the states. Is this something that we see in state constitutions, and if so, what is the trend there? Well, the right to arms is contained in 44 out of 50 state constitutions, and the trend has been a positive one. State constitutions have been adding this right, strengthening it, clarifying it. So if we're to look at how it's treated in the state constitutions, it's definitely a prong that helps us out. But I think the most important factor that the court would look to is it would look to the character and quality of the right itself. And here I think the case is overwhelming. Heller tells us that the right to arms is based on the interest in self-defense, in personal autonomy, in self-preservation. And what do we know about the Fourth Amendment and its substantive due process aspect, we know that it protects rights of personal autonomy. We have the right to control medical decisions about whether or not we're going to end our lives, Cruzan. We have the right to determine whether or not we're going to form a family, terminate a pregnancy, have intimate relations with other people who consent, have a right to be free of invasive bodily police searches, a right that pretrial detainees have. They're not bound by the Eighth Amendment, they're not, but still a right against conditions of confinement that would be horrific and unwarranted. Time and time and time again, the court has told us that an interest in personal autonomy and bodily integrity is an interest that is protected by the 14th Amendment. We need only look to decisions such as, how about Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the last big abortion case we had. The Supreme Court instructed us that, quote, choices central to personal dignity and autonomy are central to the liberty protected by the 14th Amendment. And in fact, the court went on to say that that the reason you have the right to terminate a pregnancy is because you have the right to define your own concept of existence. If you have the right to define your own concept of existence by choosing to end a pregnancy, certainly you would have the right to define your own concept of existence by having arms with which to repel a violent criminal attack that would end your existence. Lawrence versus Texas, again, spoke of the liberty of the person both in its spatial and more transcendent dimensions. Again, we see personal autonomy rights are well protected. So I believe that we're going to see the Second Amendment incorporated, and then the Second Amendment becomes a lot more interesting because, after all, most gun control regulations, most gun prohibitions exist at the state and local level. There are some basic federal firearms laws. Heller speaks to most of those, but nonetheless, where there's much more work for Dennis and I to do is once we have incorporation. I know that regardless of your views out here in the audience on the right to arms, or whether guns are a net benefit to society or not, everyone here in the audience who's aspiring to practice law is at least pro-work. And if there's anything that Heller gives us, especially if it's incorporated in an adversarial litigation system, is it's more work. I'd be happy to discuss more of this work, of which I'm doing quite a lot these days. But how much time do I have left here? About a minute and a half. Okay. Not time enough to cover the five or six different cases I have going on right now, but definitely it's going to be interesting to see what happens with incorporation. I believe as a practitioner, I have to make both arguments under the PRI clause as well as under due process. My own personal prediction is we might see some sort of a split opinion with some justices incorporating based on due process, some incorporating based on privileges and immunities. I'd be very interested to see what Dennis has to say about incorporation. Although I can tell you from having read at least the Chicago briefs that have come in so far, virtually every argument against incorporation is in some way rooted in a challenge to Heller itself, which is not going to be overturned this term or actually ever. Well, it's true. So it's a little sad to see the city of Chicago come back and talk about how the Second Amendment protects the state's rights to arm themselves against the federal government, notwithstanding Appomattox Courthouse. That the Second Amendment is all about the right of people to form militias with the state's permission. All this nonsense, I'm sorry, but it's simply all water under the bridge at this point. If the court looks to the Second Amendment that's been defined in the Heller opinion, the right of that character and quality will be incorporated. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for being here tonight. It is obviously a special privilege for me to be here, having been graduated from this great law school some time ago. I was not going to mention the year. Beth already did, so I'm exposed. It was a long time ago, and at that time, the law school consisted of just that wing of the current law school, and even that wing wasn't nearly as nice. There was nothing approaching the magnificence of this room. You all go to a great law school. I'm sure you know that by now. In fact, I brought my wife and my four-year-old daughter with me on this trip because I thought it was time that I show my daughter the law school she'll be attending. So, it is likely that the Supreme Court will address this issue of Second Amendment incorporation in the near future. Most observers think that not only will the court take one of the pending cert petitions, but that it will rule for incorporation. Alan is confident. A lot of people would think his confidence is well placed. I guess I'm here to tell you, not so fast, that I do believe that there are credible arguments against incorporation, even given the reality of the Heller decision. I've got to say this because I can't not say it. I think the Heller decision is a travesty. I think it is totally unprincipled. I think it is purely ideological, and I think history will record that. Nevertheless, it is what it is. And frankly, I don't think we should be having a serious debate about incorporation of the Second Amendment against the states, because the Second Amendment really is about the protection of state prerogatives against federal and court encroachment. It has everything to do with the militia. But obviously that argument was rejected by the Supreme Court, and we are where we are. So is there a reason to believe that the court would actually fail to incorporate this right that it has recently declared? Well, I turn to the writings of Justice Scalia himself. He wrote a book back in 1997 in which he said that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to bear arms. He had reached that conclusion long before the Heller decision. But in that same book, he added, "Of course, properly understood, it is no limitation upon arms control by the states." So Justice Scalia at one point thought that an individual right did not necessarily dictate incorporation. Well, how could he have come to this conclusion? And is it a conclusion that is still allowable under his own ruling in Heller? Well, as Alan said, under the prevailing Supreme Court jurisprudence, the only way to apply the Bill of Rights to the states is through this process of selective incorporation under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. The Privileges and Immunities Clause issue is a wonderful issue for law professors. They love to debate it. I don't think there is any way that this Supreme Court is going to reverse the slaughterhouse cases. Nevertheless, and the process of selective incorporation has pretty much replaced that privileges and immunities analysis. As Alan said, it is not sufficient under selective incorporation for a right to be delineated in the Bill of Rights. That doesn't in and of itself establish that it binds the states, and many provisions of the Bill of Rights have not been applied to the states, including the Second Amendment. And it was interesting, Alan said the most important factor under the prevailing case law here is the factor of the nature of the interest secured by the right. And that's where I think there may be a very strong argument against incorporation, because despite Alan's rhetoric about personal autonomy and all these other phrases that he used, the fact of the matter is that the Heller right is grounded in the common law right of self-defense. That is the basis for this assertion in the Heller opinion of a right to have guns in the home for self-defense. And as Judge Easterbrook noted in his opinion in the Chicago case, which is the subject of one of the cert petitions, self-defense is a common law gloss on criminal statutes. It is, after all, a doctrine of excuse under the criminal law. If properly invoked, it excuses the use of force by the victim of an attack, and it insulates the defender from criminal liability. That's what it is. Self-defense is not the same as the bearing of arms. You can defend yourself, invoke your common law right of self-defense, without having any weapon at all. As is the criminal law generally, the doctrine of self-defense has traditionally been held subject to the police power of the states. Now, as I'm sure you all have learned, there is no federal police power. It resides exclusively with the states. That is the power to adopt laws generally needed to protect the health and security of the community. to the extent that Congress enacts such laws, it has to find its authority in specific provisions of the Constitution giving it certain powers, like the Commerce Clause has frequently been used. And indeed, states have long used their police power to modify the doctrine of self-defense, sometimes expanding its scope, sometimes contracting its scope. But if you look at the nature of the interest protected by the right as delineated in Heller, it is an interest long held to be within the peculiar province of the states. And maybe that's what Justice Scalia had in mind when he wrote that he didn't think it should be incorporated. Now, I think that conservatives, frankly, should be particularly concerned about a doctrine of the Due Process Clause that gives federal courts the power to second guess the exercise of the police power by the states. And I think this should be particularly true of the regulation of guns, which inherently involves very, very difficult empirical issues, policy issues, the clash of experts, vehement opinions held on both sides, the kind of issue that we generally believe is best resolved through the democratic process. And indeed, the most powerful critiques of the Heller decision thus far, I think, have come from the right. They have come from prominent legal conservatives, people like Douglas Kamak of Pepperdine, Richard Posner of the Seventh Circuit in the University of Chicago Law School, and my constitutional law professor here at Virginia, Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, now of the Fourth Circuit, who has a very provocative article that I recommend to all of you in, I believe it is the current issue of the Virginia Law Review, denouncing Heller as an exercise in judicial activism from the right. I think there is language in Heller that reinforces this idea that because of the nature of the interest protected by the right, it should not be incorporated. And I turn to a whole section of Heller which Allen never bothers to recognize when he talks about the decision, and that is Section 3. Section 3 is an extraordinary commentary on laws that are gun control laws that were not even before the court in Heller. Justice Scalia wrote in that section, "Nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on a number of broad categories of gun laws which he said should remain presumptively lawful even under this newly discovered right." Presumptively lawful. And among those categories, he said, "Laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms, prohibitions on the carrying of concealed weapons." We're not talking about licensing concealed carry. We're talking about prohibitions on concealed carry, Justice Scalia is saying, presumptively legal even under this new right. And I would suggest that's a phrase that Allen may have a very difficult time overcoming when he argues, as he had in a case recently filed, that there is a constitutional right under Heller to carry concealed. Bans on dangerous and unusual weapons, which could include assault weapons, could include machine guns. And the court goes on and lists a number of other examples and says that these are given only as examples and that the list does not purport to be exhaustive. Now, I think this language may be fundamentally in tension with the idea that this right is fundamental under the 14th Amendment. Because, as a matter of fact, the court has said in other contexts that if a law impinges on a fundamental constitutional right, it is to be considered presumptively unconstitutional. And here's a whole section of Heller talking about these broad categories of gun laws that are presumptively legal even under this individual right. And those categories, quite frankly, are so broad that they encompass virtually the entire legislative agenda of my organization. Section 3 also suggests that at least some in the Heller majority recognize that the right to have guns in the home for self-defense implicates the public safety in ways that other rights simply do not. Sure, it is possible for the exercise of free speech to create a danger of violence. But to the extent that that danger is imminent, we hold the speech not to be protected. Guns in the home may be used for self-defense, but the studies show they are far more likely to be used in criminal assaults, in suicides, and in accidents. So there is a risk of having guns in the home that has nothing to do with self-defense, and that may be fundamentally the basis of that language in Section 3. Was that a no? Is that a stop? Okay. Let me wrap up by making one brief comment about the likely impact of Heller, even if it is incorporated against the states. I've written a book that was referred to in my introduction very nicely called Lethal Logic, and it just came out this year, and it contains a broad critique of Heller, but it also argues that Heller is basically a paradox. It's a paradox because even though it is an unprincipled exercise of judicial power, in the final analysis, it seems to constitute a very weak threat, a very weak legal threat to gun control laws because of Section 3. And in addition, over the long haul, the fact that Heller functions to, as Justice Scalia put it, take gun bans off the table as a policy matter may actually help proponents of stronger gun laws make their case in the future, because it weakens the so-called slippery slope argument that we so often see invoked by the pro-gun side in response, for example, to proposals to extend Brady Act background checks to private sales at gun shows, which makes complete common sense, and yet we are often met with the argument that, oh, this debate isn't really about background checks. This debate is about these people's desire to take away your guns, playing on the fears of gun owners. Well, over the long haul, erecting a constitutional barrier to taking away people's guns while preserving the ability of legislatures to enact reasonable gun laws to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people and save lives may very well help those who seek to enact stronger gun laws in order to protect the public safety. That's why Heller is a paradox, and that's why it's a very interesting decision. Thank you.
Well, I'm really happy to hear that the mission of the Brady Center is now limited to only those things that were contained in the Scalia dicta about some categories of presumptively lawful regulation, because, of course, the Brady Center filed a brief in the Heller case in support of the laws that got struck down in that opinion. Laws that imposed a complete ban on all functional firearms within the home, a complete ban on handguns, and things of that nature. So now that I guess those things are off the table, I'm glad to see that Dennis's group apparently will limit itself not to those things that they lost in Heller, but to those things that still might squeak by. I personally don't have a problem with too many of the laws that are listed in that little bit of dicta. Those laws are stated to be presumptively lawful. They suppose that in some circumstances that presumption might be overcome, but really the Second Amendment is not about, what I'm doing is not about restoring the right to arms to mentally ill people or felons, people who are violent and dangerous. It is about basically getting rid of laws that seek to criminalize the exercise of a basic constitutional right by qualified law-abiding people, laws such as the ones that were in issue in D.C., laws such as the ones that are in issue in Chicago, and laws such as are the ones that issue in various other cases that I'm handling. It's interesting to note that although Dennis focuses on some surplus language about felon bans and things that are not really too controversial in society, he glosses over footnote 27, where the Supreme Court specifically inserted Heller into the famous paradigm given to us by Caroline Products, footnote 4. Remember that from con law class? Here's what Justice Scalia said. Rational basis, quote, could not be used to evaluate the extent to which a legislature may regulate a specific enumerated right, be it the freedom of speech, the guarantee against double jeopardy, the right to counsel, or the right to keep and bear arms, citing Caroline Products, footnote 4. Again, the message here is that the Second Amendment is a normal part of the Bill of Rights, and it's going to be treated that way as cases unfold in the future. And that, after all, is very exciting and something that we're all looking forward to. I think that there are some problems with the notion that Judge Easterbrook offered in the Seventh Circuit
opinion. That was my case. There were two cases that were consolidated for appeal. I argued that Judge Easterbrook was not super friendly to the outcome, and he offered some dicta saying that the state can ban the exercise of self-defense, that it's simply a construct of positive law. That is some of the same argument that we've heard echoed here by Dennis. I don't think that's what the Supreme Court had in mind in Heller. If you read the Heller majority opinion, there's a great deal of discussion about Blackstone theorizing about how the right of self-defense is inherent. It's a basic natural human right. It is not something that's simply made up by a state legislature. I suppose that if some state legislature were to outlaw self-defense and to hold that self-defense may no longer be asserted in a criminal action or cannot justify conduct that's traditionally been held to be within it, that law would be struck down as being unconstitutional. And I think Heller would definitely provide a great deal of support for that proposition. It is true that many years ago, Justice Scalia wrote a book where he said that the Second Amendment itself only binds the federal government, not the states. But Justice Scalia would tell you the same thing about the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth and Sixth Amendments. Those things, of course, are true. The Bill of Rights originally understood only bind the federal government. I don't believe that he was discussing incorporation. Justice Scalia has no problem extending the original public meaning of various parts of the Bill of Rights against the states. He is absolutely one of the best justices on civil rights. All the amazing work he's done on behalf, for example, on the Confrontation Clause in the Sixth Amendment, the First Amendment, he's got some wonderful cases, and I'm sure that Justice Scalia would have no problem extending the Second Amendment to the states. He's not really one of the votes that I am personally too worried about, notwithstanding what Dennis has to say here. Guns is an item of property. That's an interesting point. So are books and newspapers. So are religious articles. So are certain devices that you might use in the bedroom with another person or by yourself. All these things have been held to be protected by the Constitution, because if you have the right to read, if you have the right to worship, if you have the right to engage in sexual relations with other people, you also have the right to the material that you would use in that conduct. And yes, you know, guns are an article of property, but I don't suppose that you could then lower the standard of review or the level of protection that you would show guns just because you want to make a property argument. I doubt that the court would approve of that. I will say one thing about these various critics on the legal right that Dennis has mentioned here. Dennis has talked about Doug Kmeck, Judge Posner, and Judge Wilkinson. Doug Kmeck, definitely one of the leaders in the Obama campaign, was recently awarded with the ambassadorship to Malta. I had the pleasure of meeting Professor Kmeck at Pepperdine when I spoke there a couple weeks before the argument. He offered commentary after our presentation, spoke very much against the right to arms, made an appeal to emotion because apparently a family member of his had been the victim of a crime. I'm not sure that too many people would look to Professor Kmeck these days as sort of a paragon of right-wing thinking in America. Judge Posner and Judge Wilkinson offer a different perspective. And here I think for those of you who may not be familiar with the Feral Society or some of the debates that occur among the right, it's important to note there are those of us who are more self-styled as conservatives and those of us who gear towards a more libertarian approach. There are conservatives out there, and I think Judge Posner and Judge Wilkinson are good exemplars of this way of thinking, that are very authoritarian in their outlook. They believe the judges should defer to what they term democracy, and that is the idea that so long as people have an election, they get what they vote for, or at least what they deserve, and judges should meekly shy away from interfering in that process. Whether you think this is a good idea or a bad idea is a normative matter. This is not the idea that the framers had in mind when they established our Constitution. More libertarian-minded members of the Federalist Society, such as myself, would look towards, I don't know, how about the Federalist Papers, Federalist 78, where Hamilton goes into great length about how the judiciary may be the least dangerous branch all by itself, but it becomes very dangerous when it's allied with one of the other branches. The framers did not trust democracy. They thought democracy was a necessary evil of sorts, but that the Congress was the place where factions would gather together to conspire against the public good and other individuals, and so you needed a strong federal judiciary to check the product of the political process. It is not clear to me
why Justice Scalia and his eight colleagues on the Supreme Court need to defer to Marion Barry's views of the Constitution, assuming he has any. The fact of the matter is that the political process is geared towards satisfying constituent demands. It's geared towards re-election, towards aggrandizing power. It is not geared towards respecting basic constitutional rights. Imagine the absolute worst judge or justice in your head, the person who wears a black robe to work, whom you like least, and no matter what else you could say about that person, you would at least have to confess that when he or she offers his or her decisions, they at least must resort to the Constitution as providing some kind of excuse for what they're doing. Your various people in public office don't do that. I offered a response to Judge Wilkinson's views in the UCLA Law Review article, the same issue that's currently out, but I believe Dennis is in, right? And I commend you to read that as well if you're interested in that debate. I have a thorough examination of exactly what it is that that conservatives, or at least conservatives who hew to the original understanding of the Constitution, look to when they look to the Constitution. And there I think you will find, as I did, that actually the framers were interested in a great deal of judicial power. Heller, therefore, stands, as the title of my article says, it's a triumph of originalist jurisprudence. This is what the framers wanted. They wanted the courts to take the Bill of Rights seriously. They wanted the courts to take the Constitution seriously, to engage with it, and to actually impose it against the political process when the political process strayed off the rails, which is what the D.C. City Council did in the 1970s. And I'm glad that it is never too late to correct their error. And that's what we did in Heller. And I look forward to correcting many more such errors in the future. Thanks.
Well, Alan is troubled by the fact that the Brady Organization filed an amicus brief in Heller on DC's side, and thinks that my presentation here represents a dramatic shift in our position. It does not. In fact, the Brady Organization does not favor handgun bans. However, we participated in constitutional cases involving handgun bans because, A, we believe that it ought to be up to the elected representatives of the people whether a handgun ban is enacted. And secondly, any kind of constitutional consideration of that possibility under the Second Amendment has a lot of danger from our point of view. The court could have, in Heller, delineated a constitutional right subject to strict scrutiny, which is exactly what Allen asked the Supreme Court to do in Heller. They didn't do that, but that hardly could be predicted at the time, and there could have been a Heller opinion that was a real danger to the kind of reasonable gun laws that we support, for example, extending Brady background checks to private sales at gun shows. We don't think the court should be in the business of second-guessing the wisdom of legislative bodies on such matters. So there was a lot at stake for us in Heller, but we didn't get from the Heller decision the libertarian fantasy that Allen sought. And beginning in the oral argument, he began to make concessions about the kinds of laws that would be constitutional even under an individual right, and the court apparently took him seriously and inserted Section 3, which I recommend you reading. It is an extraordinary piece of judicial writing because the whole section deals with issues not before the court. So you have to ask yourself, why did this five-member majority reach out from the issue before it and discuss these other laws? And I think that it was a reaction to the dissent's point of view, which was, do we really want to launch the federal courts on this enterprise of determining gun policy for America? Is that really what courts are good at? Is that really the role that they should have? And isn't it obvious that even if there is an individual right to have guns in the home for self-defense, that right is fundamentally different in nature than the right to talk about having guns at the home in the home for self-defense? I'm not making an argument that guns are different because they're property. I'm making an argument that they're different because they're lethal weapons. And the right to have a lethal weapon has never been recognized until Heller. And so I think that changes the entire issue. Now, Alan says he doesn't have a problem with Section 3. That's very interesting, because Section 3 makes it clear that one of the presumptively legal categories of gun control laws are bans on the carrying of concealed weapons. And Alan has filed a lawsuit challenging the District of Columbia's ban on the carrying of concealed weapons. So I don't know why he doesn't have a problem with at least that part of it. But again, the Heller right was narrowly confined, guns in the home for self-defense. The court reached out beyond that issue to make clear that it is not constitutionalizing the carrying of guns outside the home for self-defense, which would have even more profound public safety implications. It is true that the Heller decision rejected a rational basis test. That's true. It didn't articulate any particular test. Instead, it laid out the idea that laws that do not ban the possession of guns, but regulate the possession of guns, should be considered presumptively legal, and that is what is significant. Now, as to the conservative critics of Heller, I guess there's a tendency when a conservative takes a position that is not expected from a conservative, then the response is, well, they're obviously not really a conservative. Doug Kamak is not really a conservative. He endorsed Obama. Even though this is the guy who shared an office with Sam Alito in the Reagan Justice Department. His conservative credentials are very, very, very strong. What's going on here is that there very much is a split in conservative legal thought in this country. Not every conservative legal theorist is a libertarian of the Alan Gura stripe. There are still the J. Harvey Wilkinsons of the world who talk about judicial restraint, judicial modesty. And whatever you think about that debate, I just ask you this. Of all the constitutional issues that could come before the court, isn't it the case that the gun issue argues most persuasively for judicial modesty? These are very difficult issues, as I said before, in which you have people claiming that the more guns you have in a community, the more death you have. And you have people claiming the more guns you have in a community, the less crime you have. And there are all kinds of statistical studies clashing. And there are values at stake that are clashing. That's pretty clear, too. Those are the kinds of issues that I think we ought to have the legislature be the arbiters of. And I would say these are matters of life and death. And I think that was also implicit in Section 3. The court got nervous. The court got nervous about erecting a constitutional right that takes from you and me, takes from our communities, the power to decide these very difficult issues which involve the safety of our families and the safety of our communities. Thank you. Oh, you can go ahead.
If people have questions, you can call. If you have a question, just raise your hand.
Thanks. Dennis, you mentioned dangerous people need to have guns kept out of their hands. Who are these people and who decides that they're dangerous?
Well, we have federal laws and state laws in which legislative bodies have decided that certain categories of individuals pose sufficient danger that they shouldn't have guns. Felons are one. Congress added people who have been convicted of misdemeanor domestic abuses. People who are dangerously mentally ill are another category. And there are strong arguments to add more categories. There are states that have much broader categories of prohibited persons. But it's very, very common for legislatures, when looking at this issue, to decide even if we're going to allow law-abiding citizens to have guns for self-defense, there are still certain people whose conduct has shown them to be too dangerous to be trusted. And I think that makes a great deal of sense. It's been federal law since 1968. The problem is that we have a very incomplete system for enforcing that, because even though the Brady Law has been spectacularly successful in blocking convicted felons and other dangerous people from buying guns from licensed gun dealers, 40% of gun transactions don't involve licensed gun dealers. They're private sales between individuals. And in most states, those background check requirements do not apply to private sales, whether they're at gun shows or whether they're through the classifieds. That makes no sense. It doesn't make any sense to have an airline security system in which you go to your gate and you go into the security area and there's one line where they're checking, where they're x-raying you and checking your bags, and there's another line where they're not. Well, the people who want to do something bad on that airplane are going to go through the line where there aren't any background checks. That's what we have in this system. It doesn't make any sense. And I don't think that raises a constitutional issue. It certainly shouldn't.
So there is one little problem with our argument, though. I do know that so an unlicensed sale between private individuals, if the individual that purchases that firearm then later commits a crime with it, that can be traced back to the original owner. So there are incentives for the original gun purchaser to ensure that it's not to someone that would improperly use the firearm.
Well, only where there's registration of guns, which we also think is a good idea, which I also think is plainly constitutional under Heller. But the problem is right now, in most states, the record of the gun transactions ends with the last legal sale by a licensed dealer, because you don't have a registration system like you do with automobiles, where if I sell my gun to you, I have to tell the government about that transaction. That doesn't exist in most states. If it did, then we would have far more accountability and far more of a disincentive for individuals to transfer their guns to dangerous people. We ought to have that system. And it's clearly constitutional in my judgment.
This is another question for Dennis. You both seem to agree that the right to self-defense is not in dispute. You just believe that the right to carry arms is not implicit in that. Am I correct?
Well, I would say the right to self-defense has always been a common law right. And I don't believe that the Heller decision itself made self-defense a constitutional right. It made the keeping of and bearing of guns in the home for the purpose of self-defense a constitutional right. I think that's a distinction that may very well make a difference in considering this incorporation issue. Now, it may be that the court will take the Chicago case as an opportunity to clarify that, oh no, we meant to constitutionalize the law of self-defense, which I think would be enormously dangerous, and yet another invasion of what ought to be the legitimate prerogatives of legislative bodies in regulating self-defense.
Well, I have a different view on that. Surprise, surprise. First of all, the federal constitution regulates all kinds of things that happen in criminal trials, criminal procedures, perhaps the number one topic of discussion in the Bill of Rights, whether it's the right to counsel, the right to due process, the right to a jury trial, all kinds of limitations upon what you can do to people pre-trial, post-trial, post-conviction. I don't think that there would be any problem with constitutionalizing also, probably as an element of due process, the right to argue that you acted in defense of your life. I don't think that the state could force you succumb to deadly force as a matter of law. You have the right to defend yourself. It's always been recognized as the part of any decent, non-barbaric legal system, and I think that it's, if anything is fundamental to the concept of law in this country, it's that the right, you have the right to preserve your life against somebody who would kill you or attack you or do you grievous bodily harm. I don't think that's very controversial. Now, the right to carry is interesting. Dennis has made various statements about some case that I allegedly filed about the right to carry a concealed weapon. I've filed actually no such case. I have filed several cases, however, that talk about the right to carry, not necessarily concealed, just carry. And here Heller is very instructive. The other side made an argument, a somewhat silly argument, that bear arms as used in the Second Amendment must mean to soldier, and therefore it has some sort of a military connotation. And the court then was called upon to define the meaning of the term bear arms as used in the Second Amendment. And the Supreme Court reviewed the usage of the term bearing arms. There's a great deal of discussion on that. There's no point in repeating it here. I'll just tell you what the court's conclusion was. The court concluded that Justice Ginsburg was correct in stating several years ago that bear arms as used in the Second Amendment means to carry a gun for purposes of offense or defense. And that's what bearing arms means in the Second Amendment. And then, of course, you can do a control F within Heller and look for keep and carry. That appears in a few places. And in fact, one of the wonderful presumptively lawful things that the state can do that Dennis is so in love with in that Section 3 is the state can tell you that you may not carry a gun into a sensitive place. We're not sure what a sensitive place is yet, but that is the exception, of course, that proves the rule, because if you have, if the state may bar you from carrying the gun into a sensitive place, presumably you can carry the gun into a non-sensitive place. And a non-sensitive place does mean, you know, pretty much the default standard. A sensitive place is not the United States or the District of Columbia. A sensitive place is some sort of limited scope area where the government has probably undertaken itself to provide more than the zero level of personal security that that they owe people. I don't have a problem with sensitive places as long as we define them in a normal manner. But there is a right to carry a gun. And in fact, Heller went even further. It spoke favorably of no fewer than four cases that spoke of the right to arms as including the right to carry arms, including various cases that struck down bans on carrying guns. And if you look at the jurisprudence of bans on concealed carry, if you read those cases and if you read those treatises that Heller relied upon, if you read Heller itself, you will see very quickly that that the state may ban concealed carry only because the state may prescribe the mode of carrying arms. So the state can ban concealed carry, the state can ban open carrying, it may not ban both. It can regulate carrying, it can bar you from carrying in sensitive places, but it cannot ban all carrying at all places, at all times, by all people. That is clearly unconstitutional, as Washington, D.C. will find out sooner probably rather than later.
Can I respond to that?
Sure.
Yeah. First of all, I think this reveals what this whole legal campaign against gun laws is all about. Before Heller was decided, when I would debate Allen or Bob Levy, who's kind of the godfather of Heller, there were all these assurances that all we want to do is have the right to defend your home. That's what this is about. That's all. Now you're hearing, no, it's actually about the right to carry your gun concealed, open, and God knows what a sensitive place is under Alan Gurr's version of the ideal society, but it's clearly a right to have guns all over the place. And it does pose the issue of what kind of nation do we really want here? Do we really want a country where there is a right to bring a gun into this room? Do we want a right to have guns in schools, because that's being asserted right now? Rights to have guns in national parks, rights to have guns in even in airports, believe it or not. It's all being asserted as part of this effort to rally the Second Amendment in the cause of guns everywhere. So it raises very, very fundamental issues. There is really nothing in Heller to suggest that the court is ready to move to that kind of America. It may be, but there isn't anything to suggest it. And I would suggest that Section 3 is an indicator that at least Justice Kennedy and maybe some of the others, probably not Scalia, he's a real gun enthusiast, but some of the others do not intend to use this precedent to force us down that road of any gun, anywhere, anytime. I would add that there's a very, when the court got around to actually issuing its order in the Heller case, this is right at the end of Scalia's opinion. It said the district must permit him to register his handgun and must issue him a license to carry it in the home. So clearly, the court was contemplating the possibility that the right to carry a gun could be exercised entirely within the home. And again, I would suggest there's really nothing in Heller to indicate that the court is ready to make that other leap, that whatever risks there are to your having a gun in the home,
Now you have a constitutional right to take those risks out in public and expose other people to those risks, and even through concealed carry, where people don't even have an idea that they're exposed to the risk and can't do anything to counter it.
Well, the reason that language appeared in Heller is because the third law that we challenged was a ban on carrying a gun inside your home. I mean, that was, we challenged a ban on carrying inside your home, which was effectively another gun ban. And the court said, well, you have to give the guy a license to carry inside his home if, you know, he's basically a law-abiding, breathing person who's not dangerous for some reason. If you have the right to keep a gun, you also have the right to move it from your dining room to your living room to your kitchen. I don't think that's a crazy position. And so what did Washington, D.C. do? Did they issue Mr. Heller a license to carry a gun inside his home? No, they repealed the requirement that such licenses be issued in the first place, because they only added that as sort of a piling on top of a gun ban, and they never were serious about actually licensing people to carry guns inside their home. They did away with the whole thing, not because they love gun rights, but because their bluff had been called. Do we want to live in a nation with the Second Amendment? Well, we do. I suppose we can all move to Canada or Kuwait or some other place. Do we want to live in a nation with an income tax? Well, we do. It's in the 16th Amendment. I personally don't, but I'm not going to move. I'm going to pay my tax. You know, the Constitution contains policy choices, and these are policy choices made by the people who ratified the document or parts of it. And I suppose that we can get a militia of economists to tell us that the income tax is not really the best public policy. I suppose that we can argue about whether the Fourth Amendment, which tells judges that they need to enjoin certain kinds of undefined, murky, unreasonable searches, interferes with the right of, you know, John Walsh to bust down the door of the evildoers and do justice in America. But the fact is, look, that's the country we live in, okay? Everything in the Constitution is a policy choice. It's been ratified. We have to deal with it, live with it, celebrate it. If we don't like it, Article 5 tells us how to change it. But what we do not do is determine that parts of the Constitution are obsolete or need to be reconsidered, and then make fanciful historical revisionist arguments or other kind of expeditions in the dictionaries to disprove something which is obviously there as the highest law of the land.
This is for Alan. By focusing on the right of self-protection as opposed to focusing on the first clause of the Second Amendment, do you feel like Scalia really did a lot of the work for you for this argument for incorporation?
Well, you know, the Scalia focused on, as the dissents did, and of course everybody had to, on the meaning of the prefatory clause, and Justice Scalia accepted all of the well-established arguments for not having the prefatory clause control the outcome of the right of the people. It is the right of the people. However, if we were to accept that the prefatory clause controls the operative right, what does it say? It says that a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. That would also sort of favor incorporation if people had the right to have a gun only in service of state militia duty, because the preamble tells you that this is necessary to the security of a free state. So, in fact, we're arguing not very heavily, but it is in the briefs that I'm filing. I mean, I am referencing the prefatory clause as at least in part justification for the for incorporation being, you know, this being a very important right. Now, of course, my understanding of the militia clause is different from Dennis's. Dennis will tell you that the militia clause means that states have the right to resist the federal government with military force. I think that's no longer the case in our country. That's been disproven. If you look at what militia meant at the time, the original public meaning of the word militia does not mean some sort of armed group of people. The militia simply referred to that part of the general public that was capable of using arms for the defense of the community when called upon to do so. As the Supreme Court told us in Miller 70 years ago, the militia is something that they are civilians primarily, and they're expected to bring their own arms. The history of the Second Amendment tells you that the militia is a reason why you have the Second Amendment, because if people don't have the right to keep and bear arms, they're not going to be very good at showing up for militia duty. They wouldn't have any guns. They wouldn't be well regulated in the sense that they're trained and well disciplined and supplied either. So again, we can re-argue the militia clause, but if anything, I think it actually helps the incorporation argument.
Let me just make a quick comment complete, almost cartoonish characterization that Alan gives of the militia view of the Second Amendment. There no doubt were pretty radical anti-federalists who thought that the states should, under our Constitution, retain the right to fight the federal government. I mean, that strain of thinking goes all the way through to John C. Calhoun in the Civil War. I think the Civil War kind of decided that issue. But the Second Amendment was all about the possibility that the federal government, through its new power given it to the Constitution, his new power to organize the militia, could in fact destroy the militia, which was an institution of the states, a very valued institution of the states prior to the Constitution. And so the Second Amendment was essentially put in the Constitution to assure that the people would have the right to keep and bear arms in connection with service in a state militia should the federal government not only fail to organize the militia, but also act hostile to the organization of militias by the states. And that emerges from the legislative history of the Second Amendment. It's presented in Justice Stevens' dissent very persuasively. Unfortunately, Justice Scalia doesn't think legislative history makes much of a difference. Interesting thing, the legislative history of the 14th Amendment is a very, very big part of Allen's case for incorporation. So it'd be interesting to see if the Supreme Court turns to legislative history in incorporating the Second Amendment under the Due Process Clause after completely ignoring the legislative history of the Second Amendment, which if they'd paid attention to it, would have made clear this was all about the protection of state militias in the first place, and we shouldn't even be arguing about incorporation. So, you know, the militia interpretation of the Second Amendment should have been adopted by the Supreme Court. There were, I think, 14 historians who filed or joined amicus briefs in Heller. 13 of the 14 urged the adoption of the militia interpretation. It's a matter of history. And unfortunately, that history was completely distorted by the Heller opinion itself.
Here's some history. You know, it was agreed upon by the city in its brief that the origin, the text that eventually became the Second Amendment originated in Virginia's demand for a Bill of Rights. In fact, Virginia, when it ratified the Constitution and its ratifying convention, submitted two lists of proposed amendments. One list of amendments was called the Bill of Rights. The other one was entitled Other Amendments. Very interesting. The Second Amendment language was the 17th paragraph of the Bill of Rights amendments, and here's the 11th paragraph of the other amendments. That each state respectively shall have the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining its own militia whensoever Congress shall omit or neglect to provide for the same. That was voted down. And why would Virginia propose the same thing twice? Why would they propose the Second Amendment on the one hand, and then this very specific militia language, you know, the state has the power to control and arm and organize its militia in a document right alongside that. It's not because they forgot that that the previous language was there already. It's because these were different arguments that people had. Yes, there were demands by the anti-federalists to devolve the federal government's military authority back to the states, and those arguments were all rejected. Let's remember who won the first election in the Congress, the first Congress, the Federalists. And the most radical Federalist of all, of course, was James Madison, author of the Bill of Rights. In fact, he's on the silhouette of the Federalist Society. This is Mr. Federalist. And Madison had no problem. In fact, he recognized the necessity to assuage the concerns of the anti-federalists by agreeing to a Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights was easy to agree to because, after all, these were the non-controversial things. You know, the government should not establish a church. The government should not unreasonably search people. And, of course, the government should not deprive people of the right to keep and bear arms. However, all the amendments that were proposed that would undo the basic framework of the Constitution, definitely something that would attack the very fabric of Article I about military power, those were not going to be agreed to by the people who had just finished ratifying the Constitution. So, of course, that wasn't at issue. And in fact, we have Madison's notes from the speech he gave introducing the Second Amendment, where he described the deficiency of the right to arms in the English Declaration of Rights, that arms are only to be held by Protestants. Of course, this is one of the limitations that Madison noted, because the Second Amendment doesn't have any sort of religious limitation as to who may or may not have arms. And of course, the English Declaration of Rights does not speak about any sort of militia duty at all. Again, the history here is overwhelming, but rather than us argue about the history, all of us can read the Heller opinion and see exactly what the arguments are back and forth. We should probably take another question.
Okay, this is going to be our last question. So if you still have a question, you can ask Dennis or Alan afterwards.
Do you believe that the majority of the people feel safer, not in the isolation of their own home, but when they go out in public doing whatever they might want to do? Or do you believe that many, many people feel less secure and therefore limit the amount of things they want to do out in public, maybe particularly in the evening or whenever, just because of a fear that they don't know who might be carrying or whatever, if they knock on a door of a house, that it might be somewhat more dangerous because of the liberalization of the right to keep and carry?
Well, you know, I think that the legitimate fear that people have of criminal attack in public places is part of what makes the threat of gun violence a severe threat to our liberty as a people. And that needs to be addressed as well. I mean, we hear a lot of talk about, you know, freedom and liberty to have guns. We don't hear as much talk from the other side about the freedom to walk our streets and feel secure, and to take our kids out and feel secure. The threat of violent acts with guns is something that the American people live with, and the people of other industrialized countries don't nearly to that degree. They've figured out how to take guns out of the hands of dangerous people, even though there are dangerous people in those other countries. So I think that your point is well taken, and survey after survey after survey has shown that people feel more threatened when they know that there are individuals carrying concealed legally. They feel more threatened. They don't feel like these legal concealed carriers are out there deterring crime. They are less secure as a result of these laws which have liberalized the concealed carry. So these laws are actually adding to people's fears. These laws are opposed by the vast majority of the American people. This is another instance, as there are many of them on the gun issue, in which the will of the people is not being respected by our legislative bodies. I've been here defending the power of legislative bodies to decide this issue, but I would be the first to say that our legislative representatives, in Virginia certainly, and in Congress, have let us down because they continually play the politics of fear. They are continually intimidated by the drumbeat of the special interest gun lobby that represents a distinctly minority view that we're all better off the more guns there are in more places in our society.
Well, I think some people need to get out more, definitely, and overcome some of their fears. The fact is that the right to carry guns is one that's enshrined in our Constitution. It's enshrined in the constitutions of 44 states. And of course, we do live, as Judge Wilkinson likes to remind us, in a democracy. The fact is that the trend has been overwhelming in the recent decades. State after state after state has liberalized its carrying laws. People do get what they want, or at least what they vote for. If there was such a dislike of the right to carry, we would see a lot less of it in the political process. But the fact of the matter is that there's only one state in the entire country that completely bans the carrying of arms in public. 40 states have effectively a shall issue regime or do not require any sort of license at all to carry guns. Most of the rest, the holdout states, the right is unevenly secured, sometimes depending on which county you live in within a certain state. For example, in California, that's the way it is. I think that some of the most dangerous places in America are places where guns are banned. Washington, D.C., Chicago, these are places with gun bans. Very hard to get a license to carry a gun in the Bronx, but I don't think anybody should feel scared to travel throughout most of the United States, where the right to carry a gun is enshrined in the Constitution and is actually commonplace in practice.
On behalf of the Federalist Society and ACS, I'd like to thank Alan Dennis once again for a very lively and interesting debate. Please join me in giving them a round of applause.